concepts and examples from quantum information. So we typically consider systems of qubits. So we have a Hilbert space CD, which is equal to C2, tensor C2, tensor C2, where this is N. Two-level systems. So each state psi in C2 is called a qubit. A quantum bit, or just a qubit. So we should contrast this with classical bits. Which would be the set 0, 1. So n classical bits would be 0, 1. And you'd have n copies of that. So here the state space is the set of all strings of length n. And so on. Okay, so in the paradigm of quantum computing is that we start out with just some initial state of n qubits, and we take that initial state to be defined as the zero state. So the initial state psi naught is equal to zero tensor n. And in general, one has, this is an element of what's called the computational basis. Which consists of, basically, this list of bit strings, but as kets. So 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, sorry, this is the Dirac bar there. 1, 0, 0, and then you would have 1, 0, and so on all the way up to 1, 1, 1. So basically, this is a set of D orthonormal quantum states. But by default, the initial state is just the zero state, and then the transformation is an arbitrary unitary acting on that space. So an arbitrary unitary in UD. Of course, when we use UD instead of SUD,
What are we including that's irrelevant? You got, how many of you know the difference between UD and SUD? I'm sorry? No. I heard another tentative answer from the back. Right, so if you fix the determinant to be 1, then you remove the global phase. You may have seen in your earlier quantum courses that wave functions are only physically significant up to an overall global phase. All right, so when we go from UD versus SUD, so here for each U in SUD, for each U element of SUD, there's a set of unitaries in UD which correspond to e to the I phi U with phi some phase in 0 to 2 pi. Well, I guess I can make this a closed bracket on one side. Okay, but we're not going to worry about that, just that's something you should be aware of. It's irrelevant to, I mean, this is just a fact about quantum mechanics you should know. And so we call, why don't we just remove the phase then? So let me just put an S here, which is the special unitary group where the phase is removed because it's irrelevant. We call U in SUD an algorithm when it's designed to solve some problem. Or a quantum algorithm. When U is designed to solve some problem. So now, you might be confused about, well, how are you starting with the zero state? Well, first of all, suppose our problem is to discover something about some integer input. We want to know something about that integer. Then what we can do is, part of the unitary, which is the algorithm, there can be an initial piece of it, which just puts that number into the initial state, into one of these basis states. So you can think of the preparation of the initial state as part of this overall unitary that's your algorithm, just a matter of convention. And then at the end of the computation, we need to learn something. And so the way we learn something is to measure the state. So we need a measurement at the end. And that measurement will consist of a measurement onto computational basis. A projector-valued measure onto computational basis. So this means we look at the projectors onto the bit strings. We take some bit string and we just measure it. So remember that a PVM is a set of projectors. So here we can imagine a set of rank 1 projectors onto each of the computational basis states. And so a complete measurement of what's called the quantum state yields a bit string yields an n bit string. So typically our input to the quantum computer is a bit string, as well as a description of the transformation, which is our algorithm. And the output is a bit string, which is the outcome of the measurement. So the input and output are just like a classical computer, but what happens in between is what's different. So what happens in between, so here the measurement, we can just write it as, where J is in the set 0, 1, 2, all the way up to 2 to the n minus 1. Okay, so there's 2 to the n different values of J. Because computing scientists are involved in this, we start counting from 0 rather than 1. So that means we have to go up to 2 to the n minus 1. So now how does it work? So the first idea is to understand the notion of a quantum circuit. So the basic idea of a quantum circuit is that any unitary we're interested in can be decomposed into a sequence of gates. Any U can be decomposed into a sequence of elementary gates. So elementary gates are going to be unitary transformations which act on subsets of the qubits. So you'd have a circuit, and here's your input. And our unitary, U, which acts on the full space, followed by measurement of each of the qubits. Notice that for many algorithms, it's sufficient just to read out a single qubit. This is typically called a decision problem, where at the end, all you're interested in is yes or no to a question. And so that answer could be encoded in a single qubit where the output is either 0 or 1 for that one qubit. And so often you don't even need to measure anything beyond just one qubit. But not always. So the idea is that this type of generic unitary can be decomposed into a transformation that looks like, here, allow me to write this higher up. So here the decomposition would be something like I would have some single qubit gate. Let me call that U1, followed maybe by a 2-qubit gate, U2. And then I can also do a gate which is a controlled gate, where I might act on the last qubit depending on the state of the first qubit. And here these lines are supposed to not cross, so you write it like that. Et cetera, et cetera. So the point is that the elementary gates are typically unitary operators in U4. So this is typically. So what this means in U4 is the group of transformations acting on a four-dimensional Hilbert space, which consists of 2 qubits. So what we do is we can decompose an arbitrary unitary on the d-dimensional Hilbert space into a sequence of elementary gates that only act on subsets of qubits at a time. This is completely analogous to the classical model of computing, where the gates are, you reduce everything to a sequence of kind of local interactions. Well, this is all SU. I mean, we can talk, I mean, the point is we can describe it in terms of SU to be precise, or we can describe it in terms of U. Yeah, so if we wanted to constrain to SUD, you're right, that I'm being, so this should be SU4, yeah. Notice the only instance where this distinction is physically important is when you do a controlled U. So a controlled U will have the property that here the overall phase matters of U because it's a sub-action. I'll describe controlled unitaries in a minute, but just as a forward reference. Well, let's just look at a controlled U. So an example would be to look, so a controlled unitary has the form is apply U to qubit 2 if qubit 1 is in the state 1 and otherwise do nothing. So you would have qubit 1 and qubit 2, and we denote this way. And then the action would be, you can write phi as alpha 0 plus beta 1, and then the output state, which I'll call chi here, okay, so then we would have the initial state is phi tensor psi, and then the final state chi would be equal to alpha 0 tensor psi. That's why this board shakes a lot. Plus beta 1 tensor u psi. So now you can see why in this instance it matters if u has an overall phase factor, because the overall phase factor of u, when it's a controlled unitary, gives a relative phase between these two branches, between these two vectors, the coherent superposition. So it's a physically observable phase. Whereas an overall unitary, the overall phase is irrelevant because it just adds a phase factor to chi, which is unobservable because if we just take, if chi, well, I won't write it down because it'll confuse people, but if I just added a phase factor to chi, obviously that doesn't show up in measurable quantities under the Born rule. So the way to, the way to convince yourself of this, if this isn't obvious already, is just to look at observable properties via the Born rule. And because you have always the vector chi and its dual appear, the phase factor cancels itself. But the relative phase is important, and under controlled unitary, we allow all unitaries in U2. So here, U can be any element in U2, which a strict subset of which is SU2. So I'll write in this context.
Okay? I kind of belabor that point a bit. I mean, it's an important point, but it's not, I didn't mean to make a big deal out of it. It's just a useful fact to know. Yes?
Might we say that the phase is important here because it's not a global phase, but a relative phase?
Yes, that's what I said, but yeah.
Sorry.
That's okay.
But in general, the global phase is not.
That's right. Okay, so now this decomposition issue. So
it turns out, and we can always take the elementary gate set to be a finite gate set. That should be a little bit surprising because we have a continuous infinity of possible unitaries, and we're decomposing them in terms of a finite gate set. The key point here is that the overhead cost of approximating any U in SUD is small. So I'll get to what I mean by that in a moment. Am I writing too small? I'll write bigger. I see some of you kind of squinting back there. Okay, remind me to come back to this point once we get a better flavor for why that's important. So consider, so we call a gate set that can generate any U in SUD to arbitrary but fixed precision. A universal gate set. So the point is, we can have a finite universal gate set, and that is sufficient to do any computation we want. So here, a larger than necessary universal gate set, but convenient universal gate set would be the following. Identity x, y, z on individual qubits, the Hadamard gate, the phase gate, the pi over 8 gate, and the C naught.
So what this means is, these first gates, the first subset here, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So here, the first 7 gates are in, I don't even know if they're in SU2, they might be in U2, but let's just say U2 for simplicity. And the C naught is an element of U4. So the idea is that gates in U2 can be applied to any qubit, to any of the n qubits, and the C naught can be applied to any pair of qubits. So the C naught is our entangling gate that generates entanglement between the qubits. And the first 7 of these just are individual rotations of each qubit. And C naught can be applied to any pair. So identity X, Y, and Z are the Pauli operators, so you know what those are. Let me tell you about the Hadamard. The Hadamard is 1 over square root of 2 1, 1, 1, minus 1. The phase gate is 1, 0, 0, I. And the pi over 8 gate is 1, 0, 0, exponent of I, pi over 4. Does anyone know why this is called the pi over 8 gate, even though it's a pi over 4 in it? This whole trick of switching from SU2 to U2, so you can just write T is equal to e to the minus I pi over 8 e to the plus I pi over 8 e to the minus I. Am I ready to do this right? I think I want this to be a plus, that to be a minus. So you recognize this as a rotation by pi over 8. And then the C naught is a 2-qubit gate, so it has the form 1 which you can see in the basis 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. The action of this gate is to flip the second bit. This is a sigma x operator if the first bit is in the 1 state. So the action is to flip the second qubit
if the first qubit, called the control qubit, is in the one state. Okay, so that's the very kind of elementary introduction, and then we can talk about some applications of these ideas. The question of universality. So the point is that this discrete gate set, and here the pi over 8 gate is critical for doing this, is it allows you to approximate an arbitrary unitary with some finite sequence of these gates. Okay, I'll skip the Solovay-Kitaev theorem, unless you guys are really interested in it. That gives you the overhead cost of simulating the continuous set using a discrete set. But here's the key idea. The key issue is efficiency. So the idea is that most unitaries in SUD require an exponentially large number of elementary gates. In their decomposition. However, some U in SUD require only a polynomial number of gates. In their decomposition. So when I say exponentially large in the number of elementary gates, what I mean is, so this notion of exponentially versus polynomial growth both refer to as a function of the number n of qubits, which is equal to log base 2 of d. So we're talking about unitaries on a d-dimensional Hilbert space, and we need some number n of qubits to represent that unitary. And then the question is, how many gates acting on those n qubits do you need? And if the number of gates is exponential in n, then it's hard to implement. So these are called hard, and these are called easy. So these are, my R looks like an N. Hard versus easy. So the key idea is to find practical problems in the real world, which you can solve on a quantum computer using an easy unitary. But where solving that problem using a conventional computer is hard in the sense that the number of classical computational steps grows exponentially with the number of classical bits. Okay, so the basic idea is, to find problems, to find real problems which require, say, n bits to specify. And which are classically hard.
Whoa. Oh, that was the wrong one.
Which are classically hard to solve. So this means that, i.e., the number of classical steps grows exponentially with n. So this means proportional to. But which are quantumly easy to solve. Which means that the unitary which solves the problem, we can find a polynomial number of gates from our elementary set. Now the problem with this paradigm, the first problem you face is the fact that the computing scientists haven't done their work very well. If this is being recorded, I shouldn't make jokes like that. But the point is nobody actually knows that there are hard classical problems. So there are problems which are hard because we haven't found an efficient solution yet. And that's the best notion of hard we have. It's very hard to prove that there does not exist some clever solution that we haven't found. Exactly. So this is the famous P, and this is this. Unfortunately, there's a question mark here, which means that this is not known. So basically, P consists of the set of problems. So okay, there's a very technical way to state these. These are called complexity classes. And there's a very technical way to state them, which I won't do. I'm going to give you the kind of very heuristic description, capturing hopefully the spirit of it. And so here, the idea for P is that there are solutions, there are problems whose solution can be found in polynomial time. So now remember that in any of these problems, the problem has to have some scaling property. So the idea is that I specify the problem by the number of input bits, which is n. So the canonical example, because this is what makes funding in quantum computing so good, is factoring. So before I discuss these classes, let me give you the example of factoring, okay? And then I'll come back to this. So factoring is the following problem. I give you some, start with a large number, a very, very large number, actually integer. Now the integer, the size of the integer is specified by the number of bits required to specify the integer. So this corresponds to some number of bits, which is our, that's our problem size. So as you increase the size of the number, you increase the number of bits required to specify the number. So we have this natural scaling property. And then the problem can be find the prime factors. Find the prime factors. So now it turns out that the best known classical solution to finding the prime factors of an n-bit integer requires a number of steps. So classically, the best known solution requires scales exponentially with n.
Okay, so because I'm not a computing scientist, super polynomial and exponential are equivalent concepts to me. So actually, all I know for sure is that the best known solution scales faster than polynomially. So whether it's super polynomial or exponential, I think it's exponential, but just want to make that caveat. The point is, it's hard. So this is classically, this is a hard problem. But when we say it's a hard problem, it doesn't mean that anyone's proven that the best solution scales exponentially with n. It just means it's hard because our best known solution scales exponentially with n. Sorry, my handwriting is atrocious today. Factoring. I think somehow when I try and correct it, it gets worse because the contrast between the chalk and the smudged blackboard is less than. So, all right. My apologies. So anyway, so P is the class of problems whose solution is easy in the sense of it's polynomial. It's a polynomial complexity. And NP is a class of problems whose solution can be verified in polynomial time. By which I mean easily. So when I say easy here, I mean poly time. And poly time means that the number of computational steps is polynomial in the size of the problem, which is n. So this is, when the first time you see this, it's a bit weird. You would think you would want to define a class of problems whose solution is exponentially hard, and in a class of problems whose solution is polynomial. But the way they do it is they define a class of problems whose solution can be verified in polynomial time, but it's unknown whether you can find the solution in polynomial time or not. So think about factoring. So if I give you two prime numbers, which I say, aha, these two prime numbers are factors of this large integer, it's very easy for you to multiply those two numbers together and determine whether my solution is correct. So factoring is a problem whose solution can be verified in polynomial time. That is known. So factoring is definitely in NP. But we don't know if factoring is in P because we don't know of any algorithm which solves this problem, which finds those factors in polynomial time. So the widespread belief is that these two classes are inequivalent, and there's just been insufficient cleverness in finding ways to prove it. But it's actually unknown. And then you have, there's this incredible hierarchy of complexity classes. Some people call it the complexity zoo. And this is just very much the tip of the iceberg. But it's sufficient to illustrate the point, which is that it's believed that there are problems whose solution we can verify easily, but we can't find the solution easily. And it's also then the great discovery of Shor, of his factoring algorithm, was that he found a polynomial time solution given access to a quantum computer. So he found an algorithm requiring quantum gates, which can find the factors in polynomial time. And so this was a big deal. So Shor's factoring algorithm identifies an easy unitary
that can solve the factoring problem. Now, most of you probably know this story, but repeat it anyway. So the reason why this is a big deal is, of course, first of all, it shows us, conceptually it's obvious it's a big deal. But practically it's a huge deal because the asymmetry of the factoring problem, the fact that it's easy to verify the solution but hard to find the solution, is the premise for the widespread use of encryption to secure information. So when you want to communicate with your bank over the internet, you don't want someone to be able to eavesdrop and retrieve your banking information and drain your bank account. So you need some way to encrypt the information. You need a fast and practical way to encrypt the information, and you want it to be secure against an adversary with large amounts of computing power. And so factoring provides the RSA scheme, for example, makes use of the fact that I can privately know the two factors. So I take two huge numbers, I multiply them together, two huge primes, multiply them together, get an even huger number. I use that, I send that big number out to anybody who wants to communicate with me. So Nicole wants to send me a private message, I give her that huge number. She uses that huge number to encrypt her information, and the encryption algorithm works such that the only way to decrypt it is if you know the prime factors. So then only I can decrypt the information, even though she publicly broadcasts the composite number was publicly broadcast, the encrypted information is publicly broadcast, but only I can decipher it because only I know the two prime factors because I chose them and multiplied them together. And anybody who wants to discover the message has to factor that large number, which requires an astronomical computational, it's an astronomically large computational problem. And when I say astronomical, I mean, you know, the US government can probably do it, but nobody else can. So the point is, this is really important to information security. Basically, the fact that, you know, the commonplace encryption methods, which are commonplace because they're so effective and efficient, are broken. So a quantum computer would break the encryption schemes of today. So if we could build a quantum computer that can act on 128 bits, or if you're using 256-bit encryption, if you have 256 quantum bits and there's no errors, then you can crack all the encryption that's happening on the internet right now. Now the problem is getting 256 qubits that are perfectly clean is a problem. So we need error correction techniques, which involves massive overhead of additional qubits. So to actually do a computational problem on 256 bits would require, you know, hundreds of thousands of qubits using realistic estimates of error of errors that would occur. So this is the whole problem of building a fault-tolerant quantum computer. Requires a huge overhead. The size of the overhead depends on how bad your error rates are. Yes?
So is there a P and NP problem both for classical and quantum?
So P and NP has nothing to do with, well, it's traditionally stated in terms of classical computing. And so we have the point is then you can define quantum complexity classes. BQP is basically the set of problems that a quantum computer can solve and efficiently. And then, so Shor's factoring algorithm is in BQP, but it's not known to be in P. So what that means is it's polynomial for a quantum computer, but it's believed to not be polynomial for a classical computer. So the idea is that a quantum computer kind of changes the paradigm. Prior to quantum computing, there was this Church-Turing thesis, which basically said that it doesn't matter what kind of computer you build, they're all equivalent up to polynomial overhead. So you can't change the complexity class of a problem, well, in terms of these complexity classes at least, by just using a different classical computational technique. Basically, Turing's original idea of having a super long piece of tape with ones and zeros on it and a head that can record and read the zeros and ones and move the tape back and forth is basically the best model of a computer you can have. And whatever is happening inside your, you know, laptop is equivalent up to polynomial overhead with that very crude device that Turing imagined however many years ago. Yes?
So is NP a subset of P?
No. So the point is that P is either a subset of NP or the two classes are equal. Yeah, because the point is being in P means that you can solve the problem in polynomial time. So if you can solve the problem in polynomial time, that implies that you can verify the solution in polynomial time because you can find the solution in polynomial time. But there's an asymmetry like factoring where there are problems where you can check that the solution is right easily, but finding the solution is hard. So if someone proposes a solution, you can verify whether it's correct easily. But to actually propose a solution yourself, well, of course, you can just propose whatever you want. But to find a solution yourself would require, may not be polynomial. So NP means that finding the solution may not be polynomial, although verifying the solution is polynomial. OK, so that was more of a, I kind of wanted to go through some more technical examples to give you a flavor of how quantum computing works kind of mathematically. So let me give you an example of quantum teleportation, and we'll go through that. Now, I do have to finish no later than 5 or 10 after, because I have an important meeting at the University of Waterloo immediately after this class. So let me just try and cover this in less than 15 minutes. So quantum teleportation is the following problem. Alice is given, I'll say it the way people normally say it, even though I think this is a very misleading language. Alice is given one copy of a quantum state. So she's given some psi, which we'll consider to be a qubit. And she wants to transmit that state to Bob. But she doesn't have a quantum channel. A quantum channel is a means of sending a quantum state without ruining the quantum state. So Alice wants to send this to Bob. But only has access to classical communication, which is the only thing we all have access to. Well, the experimentalists at IQC actually set up a quantum channel link between IQC and PI across the rooftops using photons, photon polarization. So they had a quantum channel, but the rest of us don't. So how can she do this? So some of you might be thinking, well, this isn't hard. She just measures the state and then sends it to Bob. Why won't that work? I'm sorry? Yeah, exactly. So she projects the state onto the basis she measures. Suppose she measures on the z basis without loss of generality. What does she get? She gets either a 0 or a 1 when she does the measurement. Having either a 0 or a 1 tells you almost nothing about the quantum state. The quantum state psi is specified so there's a relative phase and there's a relative amplitude. So there's two real parameters required. So a single bit is falls far short of the two real parameters necessary to describe the state. So she can't measure it because she'll destroy it and get very little information. All she'll know for sure, if she gets the outcome 0, she'll know for sure the state isn't 1. If she gets the outcome 1, she'll know for sure the state isn't 0. But other than that, she knows basically nothing about the state. Now, when we say one copy of a quantum state, say I find that very misleading. Because for me, the appropriate way to think about quantum states conceptually is that they're probability distributions. And so saying Alice has one copy of a probability distribution doesn't make sense linguistically. What it means is she has one quantum system, so one electron or one photon, that was prepared in a way that's described by the quantum state psi. All right, so just remember that. It's useful, I think it'll save you a lot of heartache and paradoxical musings to avoid this kind of language, because the language can kind of, I think, can put kind of blinders on your thinking. So it's good to avoid language which is misleading, which I've just underlined for you. So the point is, she has one quantum system, and it was prepared by a procedure described by the state psi. It's a very wordy, clumsy way to say it, but that's the correct way to describe it. In other words, what she has is one sample from a probability distribution. So think about that problem. If you have one system sampled from a probability distribution, how do you communicate the entire probability distribution to Bob? Sorry, Bob is the person she's sending it to, yeah. And that's obviously a hard problem. But it turns out in quantum mechanics, we can do this via quantum teleportation. So here we have a circuit that looks like we have a circuit that looks like this. So this is a control knot. A Hadamard, and then she measures this state. Alice measures this state. This state is beta 0, 0, which is a Bell state I'll describe in a moment. And then these wavy lines mean classical communication. And what goes inside this box is XM2. And this is Z. Okay, I'll describe what all this means. And then what happens is Bob has the state psi. So the setup is this. I'm going to say some of this in words without writing it down. Alice and Bob start out sharing an EPR pair. Share an entangled state. Actually, a maximally entangled state called a Bell state. There's four Bell states, and the one we're going to consider is beta 0, 0. Which is 0, 0 plus 1, 1 over the square root of 2. So remember, this is a maximally entangled state of 2 qubits. So the resource that they have is this shared entangled state before the problem begins. So Alice and Bob are hanging out one day. They decide to share this entangled pair so they can do cool things later, whether it's, you know, win at game shows better, or whatever they want to do. They say it's a good idea. Then later on, Al says, oh, now I have this quantum state. I want to send it to Bob. She says, OK, I'm going to use the teleportation protocol to send you this quantum state. And then what happens is, so this, everything above the line is Alice. So she holds half of the EPR pair, and she also has her other state. So she has 2 qubits. Bob has 1 qubit, which is the other half of the entangled pair. So Bob does nothing until he gets in. This squiggly line means classical information. So this is a classical channel. So Alice does this action on her pair, measures the 2 qubits, sends the outcome bits, which is basically this is a single bit and that's a single bit, to Bob. And when Bob gets those output bits from Alice, he performs transformations on his qubit according to those measurement results, and then he'll get the state psi at the end. So let's go through how that works. So the initial state is, let's call it chi, is equal to psi beta 0, 0, which you can write out explicitly. as 1 over the square root of 2, alpha 0, plus beta 1, and then applying the C naught transforms the state to 1 over square root of 2, alpha 0. So when the first, the first qubit is in the 0 state, you do nothing. But if the first qubit is in the 1 state, then you flip the second qubit of the 3, which is Alice's second qubit. So you get 1, 0, plus 0, 1. And then you apply the Hadamard. And the effect of that is to rotate 0 to 0 plus 1 over square root of 2, and rotates 1 to 0 minus 1 over square root of 2. So this is Alice's action. And I'm going to combine terms in a particular way, which you can verify later is correct. And what you end up with is 0, 0 times alpha 0 plus beta 1 plus 0, 1 of alpha 1 plus beta 0 plus sorry for the equation continuing up here plus 1 0 times alpha 0 minus beta 1 plus 1 1 times alpha 1 minus beta 0, and then we close the curly bracket. So I rewrote this, I applied the Hadamard and then manipulated the state using just rearranging terms. So I skipped one step. And what you find now is that Alice has, if her two qubits are in the 0, 0 state, then all of a sudden Bob's qubit is exactly the state she had. If her qubits are in the 0, 1 state, then Bob has almost the same state. What's the difference between this state and this? So this is the initial state Alice had, which I hope I wrote down over there, alpha 0 plus beta 1. And now, if her state is 0, 1, Bob doesn't get that state. He gets one that's different. How do you turn this state into this state? Sigma x, right? So sigma x flips a 0 into a 1 and a 1 into a 0. So now if Bob, so if Alice measures her two qubits, she's going to, the projection postulate tells us the state collapses to this one. And if when Alice gets outcome 0, 1. So if her two bits are 0, 1, then Bob has this state. But so now she knows that Bob's state is different from the correct state by an x rotation. So 0, 1 outcome means Bob, apply an x. If she gets outcome 1, 0, then Bob has to apply a z operation to recover the state. If she gets the 1, 1 outcome, then Bob has to apply a y. Now a y rotation is just x times z up to a phase factor. So this means apply x and then apply z. Hopefully in that order. Yeah. So it's over there, actually. So you see now what's happening is basically, so M1 and M2 are just bits, 0 or 1. And so if Alice gets outcome 0, 0, she sends bit 0, 0 to Bob. He applies x to the power 0, which is identity, z to the power 0, which is identity. He does nothing. He gets the correct state. If she gets outcome 0, 1, she sends I guess this one is 0. He doesn't do the z, he just does the x. Oh, sorry. Yeah, so x goes first, z goes second. So circuits read left to right. Just remember that. So stuff on the left happens first, unlike when you write out a product of unitaries where it's read right to left. Anyways, you see the idea, basically. By sending those two bits, she completely determines the local action that Bob has to take to recover the state. And so, hence, one EPR pair and two bits of classical communication is equivalent in all senses to one qubit of communication. Now, if Alice and Bob shared a quantum channel, she could just send the state to Bob down the channel. You know, she has the system in the box, she could just send the system to Bob, and then she could communicate what the state was to him, because then he'd have the state. But instead, if they share prior entanglement, she only needs to send classical communication, two classical bits, in order to achieve the same result. Okay, maybe I'll take one or two questions, then I'll have to wrap up. So quantum teleportation is also a very important kind of primitive in lots of things we do in quantum information, such as error correction. It's an important kind of primitive element for achieving certain results. Yes?
So what Alice has done is share with Bob, is give to Bob the state, but she hasn't really shared the probability distribution.
Well, in a sense, now he can make a measurement and his outcomes will be correct, will be distributed probabilistically correctly.
Right, but he won't have the probability distribution.
But he won't have the probability distribution. So, right. He just has, so basically Alice has one sample from our probability distribution and she's sending Bob that one sample without in any way changing the probability distribution. But it's, you know, a quantum state is more complicated than a probability distribution. And so stories like this, I mean, this story is usually told in the language of kind of quantum states being physical. And I mean, the point, this is what Quantum Foundations is trying to sort out. I mean, there is some kind of, you know, mystery there as to, can we think of quantum states as just epistemic objects, or is there also some physical property associated with them? And that's very much an open question. And algorithms like this, and this is one of the reasons I got into quantum information, because it really gave a concise sense in which one can compare quantum and classical phenomena. Okay, well, I'm sorry to cut the last lecture a little bit short because of my meeting, but let me just say that I enjoyed teaching you guys very much. You're a bunch of very bright students. You had very good questions. Certainly kept me on my toes the whole time. And anyways, I'll be around PI here and there. I mean, I'll officially be back at University of Waterloo starting next week. Actually, I'm out of town next week, but for the rest of the term. But I come to PI regularly for talks and meetings, and so I'll see you all around for the rest of the year. So thanks again.